And it's nice to introduce Professor Philip Mayer, a distinguished anthropologist whose main fieldwork area is South Africa. Philip, how did you come to be an anthropologist?
Well, I came to anthropology relatively late in life, to be exact, when I was 36 years of age, having studied more in Germany. And passed my doctorate in Heidelberg in 1934. I left Germany, this being the time when Hitler had just come to power, the day after my oral. I came to England. I went actually first to Palestine, having had a conversion experience as a Zionist. I was denied my German identity, coming from a family which had deep roots in the Mark Brandenburg, which, as you know, is the heart of Prussia, and decided that this was the alternative solution. I came to England in 1939. On arriving here on the 3rd of September, a historical date as we all know, and gradually gravitated towards Oxford, but not yet towards anthropology. I came to Oxford because I was interested, had a newly acquired interest in the Arab world, feeling at the time that the Jews in Palestine should know much more about their Arab neighbors. And it was in connection with this work, for which I got a doctorate, a DPhil in Oxford later on, that I first encountered Radcliffe Brown in my photos in Oxford. But even then I felt that his micro-sociology was probably not my main interest. So it took some, I intended to go to Iraq and pursue my studies. The turning point was in 1946, when I traveled on a bus in Tottenham Court Road, and Radcliffe Brown sat behind me, put his arm on my shoulder, and asked me what I was doing. When I told him that there may be difficulties in my projected plans about Iraq, he said, why not Africa instead? Why don't you apply for one of the social science fellowships which the colonial office had just established? And I was interested in this proposal. That was really the turning point. Well, I had already worked under Marjorie Perrin and produced for her a reading list on betterment in the British colonies, on rural condition and betterment in the British colonies. Now I worked first in the colonial office on a land panel which Lord Haley presided over. After a couple of months I was made kindergarten sociologist. So I had met in Oxford, also among the many emigres who lived there at the time, I had met Steiner and Meinhardt, two figures who had already been anthropologists or studied anthropology before they came to England. But I myself have never had any formal training in anthropology. And had no particular relation to any particular department. So we traveled, on the strength of his appointment to the position of government sociologist, I married Iona, and Iona joined me. We traveled together to Kenya with a copy of Linton's textbook, and Maya Fortes's Dynamics of Clanship in our luggage. Now let me say the way that Iona was also a newcomer to anthropology via history at Oxford and social science in at the London School of Economics. She was appointed with a very frugal salary as my field assistant, but in fact we worked as equal partners, both there and later on in South Africa. And much of the work that emerged actually from both the Kenya period and later on is as much hers as mine. And in a way it is a pity that she later became an anthropologist in her own right, has never had the equivalent recognition, and particularly not the position, which where actually I feel her due. So that is my first experience in anthropology within in Kenya. I had no choice of a field. I was ordered by the authorities to go to the Gusii people in southern Nyanza province, and there we conducted fieldwork for about 2.5 years.
Could you say something about the Gusii peoples? I mean, what struck you most about them, and what interested you most in their society?
Well, we were totally new to Africa, and totally unprepared anthropologically, as it were. And so it was an overwhelming experience. But at the same time, an experience, a great human experience, in the sense that we recognize in the people around us types of people who are familiar to us. The sort of the common humanity struck us very vigorously. The Gusii people at the time were for a very long time actually, because of the inaccessibility, relative inaccessibility, very untouched by Kenya standards. They had been colonized only about 30 years before we arrived, and they were an admirable subject for anthropological research. They were extremely litigious, one of the most litigious people in the Kenya colony. And the reason of this tendency to resort to courts was one of the problems which at the time agitated the administrators. So we did work on a number of subjects which interested the administrators primarily, such as Gusii Rifles Law and Custom, or I published two studies in applied anthropology in Kenya, which the Colonial Office published as a command paper, and various other papers, but also theoretical papers. I remember how frivolous in those days the anthropological fraternity was about work in the, only some of them, about work as government sociologists. They sort of saw this as an opening opportunity to do the theoretical work for which the departments trained you. So, for instance, we wrote a paper on the lineage principle in Gusii society, which was obviously influenced by Hans Richard and Maya Fortes.
It's often suggested that those who worked in that period were constrained heavily by being employed by governments in applied research. Did you find that to be the case?
Well, we had at a conference recently a paper by Kaliwa who came to Tanzania or Tanganyika a bit later, and who refuted this very, very heavily and explained how freely he operated. I do think that on the whole, in spite of my political views on colonialism, to have been an insider, or up to point an insider, in the colonial administration at this time, of the late British colonial administration, was a very exhilarating experience. I think it was an extraordinarily competent and well-intentioned service on the ground. Though any political African congressman or so on was, of course, totally misunderstood and not tolerated. But I did not find that I was in any way told what to do or what not to do. The simple formula of amelioration, that one was ameliorating and doing good works in this capacity, is to me, of course, introspectively unsatisfactory, because much of the work is perhaps seen in the wider context of the colonial situation of the dubious benefit to the people for in the long term. But nevertheless, I think the recording of the law, the helping with the inflation of bright wealth, and other measures which I then devoted my time to. The bright wealth inflation was apparently a great success in this country when the people was published. It had headlines and had a poem in Punch.
Could you elaborate the theory that? Could you elaborate that theory that you had about the inflation of bright wealth?
It was not a theory. It was bright wealth, it was a highly practical applied project. Bright wealth had, as in other places too, I suppose, after the war, because of the availability of cash, gone up to a frightening degree. And led, of course, to a very very painful consequences. Well, I discovered that there had been rather complicated mechanisms to control the bright wealth rate and keep it fairly steady at the rate of 10, it's complicated how the 10 were constituted, but 10 head of cattle for a very considerable time. And it needed all sorts of far too complicated here to get into detail, all sorts of measures to make possible such a stabilization exercise. It was introduced, they followed my advice, and have worked apparently for about 10 years.
Excellent. You, returning just to an earlier phase in your career, you mentioned a number of very distinguished figures, both in anthropology and in the colonial administration, and I'd really like to talk to you about all of them in turn, but perhaps we could start by asking you whether there were any one or two figures, either in anthropology or in related disciplines, who you think of either by their personal character or by their writings have influenced you most.
Well, in my early years, certainly Richard Browning influenced me greatly. I got to know him later, when a second time he played a decisive part, I think, in my life, and was more or less instrumental in my application for the chair in Grahamstown, South Africa, Rhodes University, being favorably received. I spent then a whole year with Radcliffe Brown in a small town of Grahamstown and had the privilege of getting to know him very well, personally. And we spent many hours together practically every day. I went to his hotel for a drink in the late afternoon. And it was a great pity that in those days videotape had not been invented. because he spoke very freely about Rose's anthropology and his relation to Malinowski, his youth in his younger days, his period in France, his friendship with the Kropotkin family, and so forth. But it was, of course, the time when Radcliffe Brown, as a survivor, obviously totally eclipsed Malinowski generally in the British School of Anthropology, and I was from a distance, so I was always a bit of an outsider, or regarded myself, tended to regard myself as a bit of an outsider. I shared these views. So I think that Radcliffe Brown, particularly, was influencing my thinking and teaching, less than my work.
Could you say something, since there wasn't videotape then, could you say something more about him as a person? Because he doesn't, through his writing, certainly, he emerges much less vividly than, say, Malinowski. What sort of person did you find him?
A person not easy to get to know. A person of great, very reserved. A person who, to many people, appeared arrogant. I remember at Grahamstown, an encounter with him at Peskowitz. Peskowitz told me into stretched out hand and Radcliffe Brown, sort of pulling back and looking sort of icily curled down into little Peskowitz. But if one got to know him closer, and I think he was an extraordinary sensitive and well-meaning person who took a great interest in his colleagues. And I think formed some close friendships, but not many. He was lonely in his old age. His marriage had not been a success. He had no close relation with his only child and daughter. He had messed up his financial set by moving too many times, sort of in quinquennial intervals, as you know, from one center to another, where he left, which is where he never left his imprint on the department for many years to come. He had many facets. He had been a great dandy in his earlier years. He was known as the best dressed man ever set foot in Tata in the Transkei. He was interested at those times in arts and he instituted a three arts ball, I think it was called, in Cape Town. He had these anarchistic leanings, which he told me was in Gaston, was in France. I think that Raymond Firth's obituary, into which you probably know, sees him very clearly. But it is there were many facets, unknown facets, undercurrents in his life, which I wished I could have recorded at the time.
There was a lot of emotion as well as a lot of intellect.
I think there was much more emotion than he was credited with, yes. The relationship with Malinowski particularly was very emotional, very complex, and very difficult to sum up.
Yes.
In human terms, I mean. Yeah.
So you couldn't sum it up now?
I couldn't sum it up now.
Did you ever see him lecturing? Was he a good lecturer?
No, I don't think I did. I don't never did the lecture, I think. Yeah.
Or giving any public seminars or?
Yeah, he didn't. He refused to do it. He was not well. He did not come forward at all. No, I never saw Radcliffe Brown before. Neither in Oxford, where I had very little to do with him actually, and nor later in the theatre and stuff.
Were there any?
But I mean, to explain his enormous hold he had over so many brilliant people, I mean, seemed to me quite obvious after. I mean, his enormous concentration, which he sort of spoke to me, absolutely spellbound and fascinating, you know, about the ideas of his certain of his writing. He'd still tried to write at that time another textbook of anthropology, which was never completed.
Were there any other anthropologists? You mentioned Steiner and Meinhardt and the younger Fortes. Were there any other anthropologists who particularly influenced you or you found particularly interesting?
Well, personally, I was on good terms with them. There was quite a number of colleagues, of course, and so many of them were extremely helpful and kind to me, and I owe much gratitude to most of these members of the older generation. I don't want to enumerate some of you, McPherson and Audie Richards and Evans Pritchard. And Evans Pritchard, I was very fond of Evans Pritchard, and I had a very cordial relationship with him. But how far my own work was influenced, that is a quite a different matter. Being at a distance, I think the temptation to do your own thing was very great, which has advantages and disadvantages, obviously.
Yes. You went on, you studied the Kasai for 2.5 years. What did you do after that?
After Kenya?
Yes.
After Kenya, and then altogether my contract was 4 years, which is then 2.5 years in the field. I taught for a while at 3 institutions, half time to make a living. That was after I came back from Birkbeck, Cambridge, at Goldsmith.
To Cambridge? I didn't realise that. Who was here? Who was here then?
Fortes
and G.I. Jones and
G.I. Jones.
Rio Fortune.
And I taught courses both to students and to the cadets, the colonial cadets, largely on East Africa.
Ah, I didn't know that. And then after that, when did you go to
Grahamstown? In 1983, I went to South Africa.
Yes.
To this chair at Rhodes, which Evans, which Radcliffe Brown had occupied for 1 year after his retirement from Oxford, and after Monica Wilson had gone to Cape Town.
What, when you arrived there, what sort of anthropology did you pursue? Because you then moved your fieldwork interests and your theoretical interests somewhat.
Well, at that time I was still thinking of writing an enormous tome on the Gusii.
Yes.
And I was busy writing up this comprehensive material, really quite a massive material, which you still have and which is not written up and probably will not be written up. Iona has afterwards pursued her own theoretical interest in writing up some of the materials, first on kinship and afterwards on women. But the bulk is still there. Then I got soon interested in urban anthropology. When I was first in Grahamstown and Radcliffe Brown was still around, I organized a conference of English-speaking anthropologists. One has to make this distinction, unfortunately, of English-speaking anthropologists in South Africa, at which in the area it emerged that urban anthropology was not our concern. But nevertheless, I soon discovered that 1/3 of the black population, and perhaps the most dynamic section of the black population, lived actually in these black townships near the white cities. And I got involved in urban work. I don't know if you know, from this emerged a number of books,
yes,
John and I worked on the second volume, which theoretically introduced was concerned with network theory, but again, the network theory was only a way of explaining a empirical phenomenon in which I was interested, the differential reaction of different people different Cossack to Cossack speaking migrants to the urban situation. There was this interesting self-classification of the people into the what you call the red, what they call the red school people. and the formation of networks differed according to allegiance to one or the other of these categories. And the different networks, you know, different network formations affected the process of colonization.
When was it that you gave your famous lecture on witches? Well, that was your...
Well, the first famous lecture on witches emerged also from work we had done in Kenya, and which was provided the basis of this this lecture, which was inaugural lecture I gave at Rhodes University.
Oh, I see.
I didn't know about its fame, but I mean, I remember Radcliffe Brown was still present at it, and were approved of it.
Well, I read it with great delight and enjoyment some years ago. What are you currently working on now?
At the moment?
Hmm.
Well, my recent work was on going back to rural fieldwork in South Africa. And again, the empirical situation was a stimulus, migrant labour, which in to understand rural society in South Africa is absolutely a prime factor. This is out in a book called, which came out 2 years ago, I don't know. It is, how widely known it is. Here I use some of the methods of the new historiography, which has sort of revolutionized our picture of African history. Pre-colonial and colonial in recent years.
Could you say something about what that revolution is?
Well, it is a skillful use of sources which were available but had previously not been recognized in their importance, namely the abundance of archival material which makes it possible to pin down processes, historical processes, in great detail in localities, in specified localities, and throughout the Transkei and Ciskei. From the sort of 40s or 30s onwards, for about 150 years.
This is the 1830s and 1840s?
Yeah, mm-hmm. 1840s. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where is this material? Is it?
Well, the material is in Cape Town, Pretoria, and in still in district centres in the Transkei and Ciskei. And it is apparently a prediction. The Cape Town archive is extremely well organised, and the material is relatively easily accessible.
Does it make it possible to get down to the individual level? I mean,
yes, I think there have been recent papers by, say, for instance, William Baynard on Pondo. Went on, in which they movements have been political movements, boycott movements, religious movements could be shown in great detail and related to families, to individuals, and
What kinds of materials are the most prolific about such movements? Are they legal records? Are there legal records?
Well, first of all, administrative reports of the magistrates, visiting people from headquarters, reporting. But there are also legal records which I think may not yet have been actually utilized to the full. These are, as it would mean perhaps for the anthropologist to explore, because the political scientist or the historian has so far been mainly interested in on the movement aspect, the protests and so on, which appear in the magistrates' records, rather than the administrative records, rather than in the legal records. So I think that there's still an enormous amount of material available, which I wanted to. I knew that there is, for instance, I did this work on youth. Mm. I was very interested in. I am interested and hope to publish still my material on youth movements among the Xhosa, self-organizations of youth among the Xhosa, among the different Xhosa-speaking groups. Now, this material, these movements raised from time to time, of course, came into conflict with the authorities. There are cases about damage, there are cases about homicide, there are cases about parents disapproving of their offspring's activities. There are cases about paternity and so forth, which appear in the legal records. I think that here is an enormous source which has still to be utilized.
Could you summarize the sort of central themes of your own work up to the present?
Well, I think that the two main subjects which interest me a great deal were both urban anthropology on the one hand and socialization, as I called it perhaps wrongly, on the other. And both are aware at the time topics which were not fashionable among my colleagues. Urban anthropology, of course, has caught up and has particularly in the States become a major concern. But it was then very much in infancy. Socialization, as is well known in this country, has been regarded as an American aberration, mixing psychology into anthropology. I found that the social anthropologist has a great deal to contribute to it. And again, as I say, my empirical discovery of these enormously important youth self-organizations which flourished in this complex South African milieu proved to me their enormous importance in if you like, reproducing the social system in a rather startling way among conservative people in particular. Now, of this material, so far, very little has been published, but I hope that I may still be able to bring this out. So, in other words, having been at the periphery in many ways, South Africa, Durham, I found I was left entirely uninfluenced in the choice of subject. And so I choose these particular topics with which I sort of had to struggle more or less on my own with the assistance of my own.
Well, where you led, as you say, very large numbers of anthropologists later followed, so you were not struggling alone in the end. You mentioned the youth organizations in South Africa, and that does raise the problem for an anthropologist of working in a society such as South Africa. I was wondering if there was anything you could say about sort of the difficulties you face or the challenges.
It was certainly not an easy decision to take to go to South Africa in the first place, even in 1953. At the time, I think my liberal colleagues in South Africa like to justify the existence by seeing themselves as interpreters of African cultures to white, racially prejudiced people. As the racial domination became more vicious as time went on, our commitment, I think, intensified. And we, together with other colleagues, found that we had to do our bit to help to raise consciousness of the obnoxiousness of the system and create awareness by teaching and by writing. This is, in the South African context, perhaps not quite as much as an illusion as it may be in other societies because of the small scale, relatively small scale nature of the, at least the intellectual community in South Africa.
Have you ever, you needn't answer this question if you don't want to, but have you ever found that your work has been, you have been actively under very strong political or other pressure to alter your findings or modify your work?
There was always a battle of wits, very often a battle of wits. It was, in discussions I've always taken the line that field work or anthropological work in South Africa is possible if one handles it properly, but it is not necessarily, there are not constraints which would affect the quality of the work. I think that has been validated in recent years, and fairly radical people, even more radical than myself, have come out with work and are continuing to work in South Africa. So I think the answer is, even today, it is still possible. In spite of these pressures, absurdities of censorship and of which occasionally applies, of sudden panics about certain councils being directed by certain people, or on a fairly small scale society. But on the whole, it has been possible to continue doing work if one does it with a certain circumspection, which does not mean, circumspection is a dangerous word, it does not mean that one has to sell one's soul.
Well, Philip, is there anything else that you want to say to future anthropologists or our students or about the anthropologist's role in the world or anything else?
No, I think this is our second ending.
Yes, we'll come back in 10 years and say the rest. Thank you very much again.
Oh, thank you.